The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Acute kidney injury and chronic kidney disease is presented by Dr. Mark Baldwin.
The slide deck that you have for the AKI lectures, 80-some slides, and I'm sorry, I can't talk that fast. Most of those are for your reference. I'm giving an abbreviated version here, so I've kind of trimmed the greatest hits. The other things in the slide deck are for your study and for your reference. And what I'm going to be doing is this is going to go over a half hour, so I'm just going to lead this right into the second lecture, which is tubular interstitial disease. So no further ado, disclosures, still working for the man. Got a case here. A 67-year-old female was admitted to the hospital for a three-day history of nausea, anorexia, and diarrhea. She'd been in good health prior to this, except for symptoms of GERD dating back a decade. Her previous PCP recommended omeprazole over-the-counter, two 20-milligram tablets daily, which she's been taking for over 10 years. 10 days ago, she complained of the flu and was treated with amoxicillin, and she's taken the entire 10-day course. Past medical and surgical histories are all negative. A full lab profile 3 years ago was all normal. Her current meds included multivitamin, omeprazole, and again, she recently finished a course of amoxicillin. Review of systems is remarkable for decreased oral intake, nausea, watery diarrhea for the last 3 days, general malaise, fatigue, but she denies any rash, perioral ulcerations, hematuria, or pyuria, period. The rest of her review of systems was negative. Physical examination, thin, frail, acutely ill woman, blood pressure 88 over 60, pulse was 116. Her HWNT exam was remarkable for some mild bitemporal wasting and dry mucous membrane. She was tachycardic. Really, the rest of her exam was remarkable only for some decreased skin turgor. Her lab, sodium 129, potassium 2.9, chloride of 100, bicarb 17, BU and creatinine were 30 and 3.3. White count was 9.6. She was mildly anemic. Her SED rate was 29. The rest of her profile was pretty much unremarkable. This is something we see in, for those of us that do hospital medicine, this is kind of the bane of our existence, the patients that come in and we're trying to figure out, you know, is this new, is this old, how much of it's new, how much of it's old. So hopefully you'll get a little bit of a pathway here in trying to differentiate it. For years, we had two goalposts when it came to kidney function. We had normal renal function and end-stage renal disease, and everything in the middle was kind of a terra incognita. And we've been able to define stages of chronic kidney disease, but also we've reassessed several times our definition of acute kidney injury. And today, a good working definition is an abrupt increase in the BUN and creatinine with correspondent problems with handling of fluids, potassium, phosphorus, and acid-base balance. Generally, it's a 25% decline in the GFR. Decrease in urine output may or may not be reflective of acute kidney injury. We have non-oligarch renal failure, too. So one of the problems, and as we all know, if you get two doctors together, you get three opinions and an argument. And one of the problems with the definition of acute kidney injury is that serum creatinine may not reflect the degree of renal dysfunction or improvement. There's a lag period. Urine output also may or may not reflect the degree of renal dysfunction. So we've evolved to the term of acute kidney injury. In 2002, they came up with the RIFLE score, and then this was revised in 2007 to the AKIN definition. And in 2012, they came up with a revised version of the AKIN. Generally, if you have a 0.3 bump in the creatinine, that's acute kidney injury. How common is this? Well, it's only seen in about, AKI is only seen in about 1% of patients at time of admission. However, there's a 2 to 5% incidence of patients who develop this during their hospitalization. 67% of critical care admissions have some degree of renal dysfunction. And 23% have either residual chronic kidney disease or in previous kidney disease have a worsening of their staging. The hospital mortality is still about 50%, even with dialysis. 40 years ago, prior to widespread use of dialysis, acute kidney injury still had about a 50% mortality rate. We're just seeing sicker patients now. So we say people die with acute kidney injury rather than of acute kidney injury. There's three phases to really think about in acute kidney injury. There's an initiation phase. That's when the damage is done. It's a drop in blood pressure, exposure to nephrotoxins, early sepsis. And we see this as an increase in the BUN and creatinine and perhaps a decrease in urine output. You can have oliguric or non-oliguric acute kidney injury. Oliguric implies less than 400 to 500 mLs of urine a day. The reason we choose this value is that this is the minimum amount of urine a person has to put out in order to clear their daily osmotic load. If they overcome what caused them to go into acute kidney injury, then they'll go into a recovery or a diuretic phase where we have a marked increase in the urine output. The body's trying to catch up, but in the process, where the patients are prone to going back into acute kidney injury from volume depletion or having arrhythmias from electrolyte abnormalities. So just because they start peeing doesn't mean everything's fine. We still have to follow them fairly closely. Generally, most of what we see in acute kidney injury, especially in the critical care unit, a good chunk of this is acute tubular necrosis. Prerenal causes, which I'll get into in a minute, acute on chronic kidney injury, obstruction, and then all the cool things that make us go into nephrology as nephrologists, the acute GNs and those kind of things that Dr. Pryor will be talking about. So right now, for all practical purposes, this is kind of our working definition of acute kidney injury. One of the first things that we do as nephrologists that can really help us is a renal ultrasound. At Pacific Northwest, we're actually instituting a ultrasound curriculum for our medical students because for those of you that work with point of care ultrasound, this is really has been revolutionary in patient care. And I refer to a renal ultrasound as a poor man's biopsy. I can get a lot of quick information. I can differentiate, and I'll show you a slide here, how we can differentiate acute versus chronic kidney injury, if there's an obstruction, if there's masses, if they have increased abdominal fluid. And we don't have to worry about prepping them for contrast or radiation exposure. Bladder scan. Sometimes the most important answers are the simplest ones. And sometimes you can be the big hero by doing a bladder scan and saying, they have acute Foley catheter deficiency. Angiography, we will sometimes order angiography, especially if we're considering pyelonephritis nodosum or vasculitis. Intra-abdominal pressure, this, for those of us that do a lot of critical care work, this is really important in looking and following patients, especially when the surgeons or whoever are dumping tons of fluid into the patient and they're starting to swell up like the Michelin man. This is a good way to monitor, and I'll talk about this in a minute. Laboratory test, you know, again, this is kind of dependent upon your clinical suspicions. And these are some of the common ones. that we love to order is, those of you that have done your nephrology rotations know, we like to order a lot of geeky tests. couple things for boards. Anti-double-stranded DNA is specific for end organ damage, anti-histone antibody for drug-induced lupus. ANCAs, we also have ANCAs that can become positive in exposure to certain medications, namely propithiouracil and hydralazine. When all else fails, we get a renal biopsy. And yes, some of us old-timers still look at urine. I refer to it as reading the patient's tea leaves. This is one of the things that gets nephrologists all excited, and these are red cell casts. This may be showing up on a board exam. Look for a couple red cells. If they're close to a cast, the answer is going to be a red cell cast. This is definitive for acute glomerulonephritis, okay, which, again, Dr. Pryor is going to talk about in a minute. These are white cell casts. Again, these are clumps of white cells. We can see this with chronic indolent infection, but we can also see this with chronic inflammation, okay, that have non-infectious etiology. When all else fails, we get a renal biopsy. The indications, generally my threshold to biopsy a patient's fairly low because I can get, you know, ultimately, this is the ultimate imaging technique, you might say. Unexplained acute kidney injury, unexplained hematuria, proteinuria. We do it to not only establish a diagnosis, but also to guide our therapy. If we have somebody who comes in with who we think has acute kidney injury, we do a biopsy. If we see a bunch of fibrosis, we're not going to expose this patient to a bunch of nephrotoxins where we're not going to get a good yield. If we see a lot of inflammatory cells in that, we'd say, okay, this person is going to benefit from immunosuppression. So can we go back a slide? Yeah, there. Okay, contraindications, if they have small, contracted, echo-dense kidneys, this is not going to benefit us in the least. All it's going to show is they have scar tissue in the kidney. Solitary kidney, this is a relative contraindication. One of the biggest complications from traditionally from renal biopsies have been hemorrhage. Remember, you're dealing with a highly vascular organ. Obviously, active infection, uncontrolled hypertension, coagulopathy, or the patient currently on anticoagulants, and an uncooperative patient. Although the kidney is about the size of your fist, it's not that hard to hit, but what we want is cortical medullary junction, which is the outer 10%. So there is a little bit of a skill in trying to get glomeruli. So in the patient we were discussing earlier, and we're trying to figure out, is this acute or chronic? There's kind of a little thumbnail thing on how we can differentiate that. Acute kidney injury, frequently there's a well-defined precipitating event. They come in with an infection. They're hypovolemic. They have had the therapeutic trial of contrast and antibiotics, and now they have AKI. They have an obstruction. We have something we can pinpoint in this case. On ultrasound, they'll have normal-sized, non-echo-dense kidneys. They aren't obstructed. They'll have a normal PTH, normal hemoglobin and hematocrit, normal phosphorus and calcium. And we may see red cell cast, white cell cast, or granular casts on the urinalysis. This is all indicative of AKI. Now, chronic kidney disease, they're going to have some kind of underlying condition. Most common cause of chronic kidney disease in the United States, number one is diabetes, number two is hypertension. Do they have a history of lupus? Are they using NSAIDs or proton pump inhibitors chronically, or has not seen a physician in decades? On ultrasound, do they have small echo-dense kidneys, normocytic, normochromic anemia, metabolic bone disease with elevated PTH and phosphorus that we see with late stages of chronic kidney disease. So, and again, this is how we differentiate this. By definition, anuria is less than 100 mLs of urine a day. And we differentiate this also by location. Is this a prerenal problem, which is a decrease in the actual or effective circulating volume? We talk about effective circulating volume. A classic example is congestive heart failure. They don't have a good pump, hence the kidney is not responding the way it should. Post-renal, this is a flow problem. This is an obstruction problem. And then intrinsic is a direct result either to the vasculature, the glomerulus, the tubules, or the interstitium, or any combination thereof. So this is a nice diagram that shows this, and I'll talk about each component shortly. Post-renal, this is real easy. This can be acute, this can be chronic, this can be acute on chronic. Functional renal recovery depends upon how quickly we relieve the obstruction. Frequently, if this is an acute problem, when we relieve the obstruction, they'll go into a post-obstructive diuresis. And we need to follow the patient for the next day or two, at least, to follow their fluid status and their electrolytes. In patients with intense ascites, check the intra-abdominal pressure. Generally, we like to keep it under 10. Once they go above 13, start getting concerned. Once you go above 25 millimeters of mercury, you're starting to have intra-abdominal ischemia, which means the biggest organs, the liver, the kidney, and the gut, are all at risk for becoming necrotic. So it's something I fairly closely follow in patients in the ICU. Most importantly, our role is to contact either the radiologist or if it's after 3:30 or on a weekend, consult the urologist to come in and relieve the obstruction. So, common causes of this, renal stones, calcium oxalates, most common cause, followed by uric acid, struvite. If you see struvite, think chronic infection, especially with Proteus. Strictures, do they have retroperitoneal hematoma, fibrosis from radiation of the abdomen, or a tumor, obstructing casts that we see with myeloma, rhabdomyolysis, and acute tubular necrosis, benign prostatic hypertrophy, neurogenic bladder, intrarenal, extrarenal tube tumors, renal vein thrombosis, and again, increased intra-abdominal pressure. This is a picture, even if you're not trained in ultrasound, you see that big garden hose coming out. That's an obstructed ureter. We have marked calyceal dilatation here. And this, here we have the hydroureter, and we have the calyceal dilation here. This is an acute urologist deficiency. So, prerenal, again, this is a decrease in either the actual circulating volume or the effective circulating volume. Either way, the body is either actually volume depleted or think it's volume depleted. So what happens is we have augmentation of the renin-angiotensin system, increased sympathetic tone, increased antidiuretic hormone, all in an attempt to hold on to water. If you see an exam that gives you some urine data in prerenal, you're going to have a low urine sodium and a high urine osmolarity. When we see a patient with this, the first thing I do is in the house is review the intake and output, review their blood pressures to see if they've had a transient drop in blood pressure or if they came in with elevated blood pressure, systolic blood pressures in the 160, 170, 180, and now they're down to 130, and people with severe atherosclerosis, this can lead to some mild subclinical AKI. Really have to evaluate the patient's volume status. As nephrologist, one of our ultimate philosophical questions is the patient wet or dry, okay? And this is one of the things that kind of drives me crazy when I get called on about a patient. I say, what's their volume status? And, you know, I get kind of a little hedging there. It's not that hard to figure out. This is, I'm kind of showing my age because when I was a resident and a fellow, we put in a lot of Swan-Ganz catheters that was mandatory to go into any kind of critical care unit. And this is an example of how to check skin turgor very easily. The reason why we use the neck is because this is the last place to lose collagen. So this is, my students and residents always see me going around pinching patients' necks to see their volume status. So causes, dehydration, hemorrhage, steroids, protein loading, GI losses, sepsis, excessive sweating, prolonged hyperventilation, we have a large insensible losses, heart failure, cirrhosis, nephrotic syndrome, cardiorenal, hepatorenal syndromes. In here we have decreased effective circulating blood volume, the ubiquitous third space losses, and then the diuretic phase of acute kidney injury or over-diuresis or rapid correction of hypertension. So fractional excretion of sodium, this is something I know in the past has been asked on boards. Normal value is about 1% of the 100% of sodium is filtered in the urine, 99% normally is reabsorbed. So if it's less than 1%, that means the body's trying to hold on to as much sodium as possible and the kidney is responding appropriately. If it's above 1%, say 2, 3, 4%, I like to describe that the kidney's hemorrhaging sodium. This is a real helpful chart. You never know when this is going to show up on boards. This is a quick and dirty way of differentiating ATN from prerenal azotemia. Intrinsic renal AKI, again, this can be vascular, glomerular, interstitial, or tubular, or any combination thereof. Frequently, we'll see a number of episodes of AKI or acute glomerulonephritis that'll frequently involve the lungs. We refer to these as pulmonary renal syndromes. Classically, this is they all usually present with crescentic glomerulonephritis, and the big ones are lupus, Goodpasture's, IgA, Berger's disease, or Henoch-Schönlein purpura, ANCA-mediated vasculitis, post-streptococcal GN, and immune complex GN frequently present as pulmonary renal syndromes. Vascular components, we have renal artery obstructions, either a vasculitis, polyarteritis nodosa, embolism, thrombosis, or from an aortic dissection, renal vein thrombosis, and sometimes if this is unilaterally, these patients may be asymptomatic. Malignant hypertension, sclerodermal renal crisis, severe sustained hypotension, post-open heart surgery. When I get consulted on an open heart case, the first thing I look at is what's their cross clamp time and what's their pump time if they did an on-pump bypass. Atheroembolic disease, and then microangiopathic conditions such as DIC, HUS, what we'll talk about in a second. So glomerular AKI, we see the RPGNs. I'm going to talk a little about it. Dr. Pryor is going to talk a little about the immune complex we see with lupus, cryoglobulinemia. If you see cryoglobulins, think hepatitis C, and then IgA. Acute interstitial AKI, the big one here is acute interstitial nephritis. Classically, we see this with antibiotics, and currently the big one is Bactrim, but we can pretty much see it with any type of medication. Chronic infection and systemic illness can all lead to a state of chronic inflammation. I'll talk a little more about this when I talk about tubular interstitial problems. In tubular injury, this can be ischemic or cytotoxic, and ATN is the model for ischemic. Cytotoxic, again, involve drugs, crystal formation, or obstruction. One of the big ones that I've kind of gone on a crusade about are proton pump inhibitors. If you remember from the case, this lady had been on antibiotics, she'd been on a proton pump inhibitor for 10 years and presented with diarrhea. Okay, first thing I would think of, does she have C. diff? Because we know people who are taking proton pump inhibitors, the incidence of pneumonia and C. diff has just skyrocketed as a result of this. So these are some of the renal effects. ATN we have is due to thrombosis of the vasa recta with microvascular ischemia, then leading to, think of tying a string around your finger and your finger falls off. You make the tubular capillaries ischemic, you're going to slough off tubular epithelial cells. And these can be due to a number of different mechanisms. ATN can also be the final result of untreated, prolonged, pre-renal or post-renal. This is a nice example of ATN, and what you'll see here are the tubular cells that are vacuolated, they're edematous, and they're ready to burst. Here you have areas that are pretty much denuded of tubular epithelial cells. This is what we're talking about with ATN. Here's another view. The gunk in the middle is going to form a granular cast or a dirty brown cast. So, management of acute kidney injury in the absence of hemodynamic shock, the go-to fluid is still crystalloid. If you want to use Ringer's lactate, that's fine. If you want to use normal saline. There is a growing trend toward using Ringer's lactate in a lot of the critically ill patients because of incidence of metabolic acidosis. However, I have a file like this in my office of comparing Ringer's lactate to saline, and it's equally divided. We need to closely follow endpoints, hemodynamic parameters, oxygenation for at-risk patients, keep the blood glucose under 150. When it goes higher, they have an osmotic effect, which can further get the patient into trouble. Don't use diuretics routinely to prevent AKI. Always have a purpose with what you do. And we use this mainly to treat, again, volume overload. Renal dose dopamine still does not work. Repeated doses of diuretics in the face of anuria and no evidence of obstruction generally don't work. We know what does work is dialysis with biocompatible membranes. Pretty much, as we know over the years, pretty much everything has been tried to treat AKI, and there's no medical treatment because, again, the cells are damaged and we need to give them time to recover. Place a Foley catheter, okay? You can be the hero on a number of occasions by simple mechanisms. So, what about fluids? As a nephrologist, I tend to like wet patients up to a point. That's what the good Lord made loop diuretics and dialysis for. But this was the original FACT trial came out in, 2007, that looked at fluid management in people with critical care admissions who had acute respiratory failure. And what they found was the more fluids you gave, the worse the patients did. When they did a subgroup analysis of about 306 patients out of the original study group who had AKI, they looked again at liberal versus conservative fluid management and furosemide use. What they found was they defined the liberal fluid group that had an excess of 10.2 liters after 6 days compared to the conservative fluid group that had an excess of 3.2 liters or less over 6 days, and they found that the liberal fluid group did a lot worse. You know, remember the Frank Starling curve. You can only load the ventricle so much, and at one point, you get into the law of diminishing returns. What they found was the higher the furosemide dose, the higher your Lasix dose had a better outcome, had a lower mortality, but had little effect on fluid balance. So there's probably some non-diuretic effects of furosemide. When we talk about contrast-induced prophylaxis, the big thing to remember, if you see a board question with this and they say, what mechanism is the most effective in preventing AKI, contrast-induced AKI in diabetics, it's holding metformin for 48 hours, okay? That's the big one. So I'm going to give you a couple scenarios here. Patients who develop a scleroderma renal crisis or malignant hypertension. This is a picture of scleroderma renal crisis. Again, we see the onion skinning of the arterioles. There's some mild fibrinoid necrosis. These patients present with classic high output failure. They're hypertensive. They have papilledema. They have an S3, an S4. They have a headache. They'll have hematuria, AKI. The treatment of this, even in the face of AKI and scleroderma, is still an ACE or an ARB because this is a renin-dependent mechanism. Polyarthritis nodosa, this involves painful skin rash, levito reticularis, tend to be a little more common in men than women in the fourth or fifth decade. Frequently, this may be associated with hepatitis B or C. They present with hematuria, proteinuria, acute kidney injury, hypertension, and polyneuropathy. They'll also frequently have abdominal pain, myalgias, and arthralgias. If you see an x-ray or an angiogram that looks like cherries on a tree here, it's polyarthritis nodosa. We treat this with steroids and cyclophosphamide. Clustral emboli syndrome. This is something that classically in the past we saw post-procedures, either a cath, CABG, or some type of cardiovascular surgery. We also see it in people who have severe diffuse atherosclerosis. You can have spontaneous atheroemboli, and usually the third or fourth toe are one of the first places affected by this. You'll see a stair-stepping of the renal function. What that means is the creatinine will go up a little bit, stabilize for a few days, go up a little more, stabilize, go up a little bit more. Classically, we see this with the white cells in the urine, white cell casts, elevated sed rate, and low complements. On biopsy, we see the cholesterol clefts, those little white needles there. Those are the cholesterol clefts on biopsy. Hemolytic uremic syndrome, or TTP, these present both with microangiopathic hemolytic anemias, thrombocytopenia, and acute kidney injury. And generally, if the kind of our rule of thumb is it involves the kidney, it's usually HUS. If it doesn't, it's usually TTP. Classically, we see it's associated with toxigenic E. coli. Pregnancy, cancer, and drug-related are a little bit more commonly seen with TTP or atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome. If they have bloody diarrhea, this is actually a good prognostic sign. So if somebody says, I have bloody diarrhea, tell them you hope it's hemolytic uremic syndrome. They'll have a purpuric rash, abdominal pain, hypertension, hematuria, red cell casts, and AKI. Obviously, they're going to be anemic and thrombocytopenic. Their LDH will be elevated and have a low retic count and decreased haptoglobin, again, consistent with a hemolytic anemia. You can have pulmonary involvement, and if they have CNS involvement, that's a very poor prognostic feature. On peripheral smear, you'll see schistocytes and helmet cells. These have been known to show up on exams. So how do we differentiate this? Well, TTP involves toxins that disable the ANOPS TS13. This leads to thrombosis from activated von Willebrand factor. Acute kidney injury is usually less common, and we diagnose this with a low ADAMS TS13 compared to hemolytic uremic syndrome, which leads to a dysregulation of the alternative pathway of complement and is much more common, and the ADAMS TS13 levels will be normal. So you may see this in the near future when you take an exam. So this is one of my favorite commercials here. Toxin related, so yeah. So this is a fibrinoid necrosis. This is called a Jones stain or a silver stain, and we see all the little necrotic areas. And again, this is an example of helmet cells or schistocytes. It looks like somebody took a bite out of the red blood cell here. Treatment of HUS, steroids, plasma exchange, eculizumab or rituximab, especially for CNS involvement and dialysis. RPGN, Dr. Pryor's going to get into these in a little while. These always are formed crescents. Pulmonary renal syndromes are very common. Frequently, they'll describe, I was feeling fine until a week or two ago when I got a cold or got the flu, and last couple days I've been peeing out blood and have this rash and I feel terrible. Two of the big things we look at here are the ANCA-related and lupus. We have granulomatosis with polyangiitis, formerly known as Wegener's. eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, which is Churg-Strauss, which is always associated with asthma, or microscopic polyangiitis. We have anti-glomerular basement membrane mediated IgA, which is very rare, or Henoch-Schönlein purpura. Again, they present sick, they have hematuria, they may have hemoptysis, they'll have low complements, elevated sed rate. We're gonna see red cells, acanthocytes, red cell casts, and white cell casts, along with granular cast. Always have a high index of suspicion. This is an example of a crescent here. As you can see, this is kind of crowding out the remaining necrotic glomeruli here. We also will see some thickening of the microvasculature here. And this is a classic biopsy of an RPGN. Henoch-Schönlein purpura, thing keys to remember here. We see this in kids, and then we see it again in adults in their fifth or sixth decade. This is an IgA-mediated multi-system disease. You have palpable purpura, which coalesces arthralgias and fever. Frequently, they'll have abdominal pain, intussusception, which is more common in kids. They'll have hemoptysis, hematuria, and acute kidney injury. AKI is a little more common in adults as opposed to kids, but also leads to a poorer prognosis. Classic thing we see on presentation, red cells, red cell casts, mild proteinuria, and then on a biopsy, we'll see ATN crescents, and it will stain for IgA. This is an example of the coalescing rash of IgA, and this is Mozart, who supposedly died of Henoch-Schönlein purpura. So if you'll learn nothing else from this, you'll remember this a year from now. So again, on renal biopsy, what do we see? We see crescent formation. We have some fibrinoid necrosis here. And this is an example of an immunofluorescence for IgA. Goodpasture syndrome, this is an IgG antibody directed to the alpha-3 chain of type 4 collagen, which is only found in two places, in the glomerular basement membrane and in the alveoli of the lung. This can present either initially as an acute GN or a pulmonary hemorrhage. Usually if they have one, they'll eventually develop the second one. Not uncommon if they present together. About 30 or 40% will have hemoptysis. Obviously, the high-risk people are smokers or people who've had a recent upper respiratory tract infection. Again, they present with an acute glomerulonephritis. Anti-GBM titers will be positive, and ANCAs may be positive, and we're not really sure why, but this is more what we see with good pastures. You'll see linear deposits of IgG on biopsy and crescents. In teens that get this, or late adolescence or early 20s, men tend to get this a little more common than women, and they present with both. In the 50s, there's a reversal of this where females present a little more commonly with this than men, and the renal manifestations are much more common. Acute interstitial nephritis, this is classically associated with medication. Generally, we need to be on a drug for 7 to 10 days if that would come up on a board exam. Pretty much any drug can cause this. Infections, autoimmune, we also have seen this related to malignancies. They present with a fever, rash, malaise, eosinophils. When Dr. Pryor and I trained, this was the definition of this was eosinophils in the urine. Well, in reality, we only see this about 20-30% of the time at best, okay? However, if you see an eosinophil in the urine on a board exam, the answer is acute interstitial nephritis. They'll have mild protein, and on biopsy, they have what I call an angry slide. We see a lot of infiltration of inflammatory cells here around the tubule, and on close-up, again, we see all these inflammatory cells here that leads to acute kidney injury. Treat this with withdrawing the drug and steroids in advanced cases. So Rhabdomyolysis, this is well recognized in trauma and frequently seen in non-traumatic settings due to muscle breakdown or release of myoglobin. Frequently impaired level of consciousness is a frequent complication of this. People who overdose or get hit in the head or have a stroke where the dependent side becomes ischemic or very prone to this. We can also see it with refeeding syndromes. The key for diagnosis is a large blood on urine dip and minimal red cells in the urine because, again, the myoglobin cross-reacts with hemoglobin. The creatinine rises much faster than the urea nitrogen. Again, this is released from the muscle tissue. They have an elevated lactate, elevated phosphorus, elevated potassium, and LDH. You could develop a compartment syndrome of this. The treatment is early aggressive IV fluids. The whole alkalinization of the urine has been up for debate for years, but the key is aggressive hydration. Dialysis may be needed to bridge them until they recover, though they usually have pretty good recovery. So indications for acute dialysis, this is also something that's been known to show up on boards. Acute uremia, either encephalopathy, pericarditis, or uremic bleeding, refractory congestive heart failure, refractory electrolyte balance, especially potassium, refractory acid-base disorders, and toxin removals. Things that removed by dialysis, and these have been known to show up too. You need something small molecular weight, non-protein bound, gets cleared very easily. Lithium, aspirin, alcohol, methanol, ethylene glycol, all these are easily removed by dialysis. Tricyclics are not removed. If you would see this on a board question and say, which of the following do not get removed with dialysis, the correct answer is tricyclics.